Hello, and welcome once again to KHOI's Community Bookshelf. This is Mary Richards. We are reading The Horizontal World, Growing Up Wild in the Middle of Nowhere, by Deborah Marquardt. It was published in 2006 by Counterpoint, a member of the Perseus Books Group in New York. We rejoin this story as the author is describing her parents' courtship. At this precise moment, she is talking about a childhood illness that her father had that left him with scarred lungs. As a last resort, one of the uncles had summoned the brochure, a midwife and healer in our town, who used chants, herbs, and poultices to cure the sick. My father was too young to remember the details, but he often told the story to us as it had been told to him. How the old woman sat by his bed through the day and night, mumbling prayers over him in German. How she had spoken directly to the illness, warning it to leave his body and burn elsewhere. How she had wrestled with the fever through the long night, insulting it by calling it a little fire, as she fed him internally and doused him externally with a milky remedy made of boiled wormwood, a stinky green weed that for the duration of his life my father refused to spray or cut down when it grew in his fields. Later he would confess to my mother that he had avoided getting married in his early 20s because he didn't believe he would live to old age, and the situation soon proved grave. By his mid-20s, the scarring on his lungs from the pneumonia grew into tumors that necessitated the most damaged lung be removed. This was around the time my mother started dating him. The surgery was so perilous that it had to be done at the Mayo Clinic. Fortunately for him, my mother was a strong young woman, and they were in love. They resolved to get married if he survived the operation. On the strength of this agreement, my father headed off to Rochester, Minnesota, in his Uncle John's car with a wad of borrowed cash in his pocket and a promise to my mother that he would call her at such and such a time if he survived the operation. On the day of the surgery, my mother waited at the allotted time and place for the all-important phone call, which did not come and did not come. Then she went home, had a good long cry, and prepared to begin talking about my father in the past tense, the man I almost married, the man with whom I'd hoped to have children. Weren't we kids all glad that he did call her hours later when the anesthesia wore off, before our decisive mother wrote him off entirely and set her cap for some other man, landing us all on the planet with different noses, cheekbones, hair, and eye colors. This was how distantly mythic our parents' courtship had seemed to us growing up. But by the time of my birth, my family was a well-oiled machine. Within 4 years of marriage, my parents had produced as many children, 1950, 1951, 1952, and 1953. They turned us out like Chevys. I appeared in 1956 after a 3-year hiatus. Was there a labor dispute between them? A breakdown in union talks? Or had my clear-eyed mother simply made adjustments to her new Catholicism? Whatever the reason, my arrival meant we'd be trading in the sedan for a station wagon. As the last model to come down the assembly line, I ended my parents' procreative efforts. For as Father liked to say when he became overwhelmed with us, once he and mother determined what was causing children, they promptly put an end to it. My mother was a Lutheran when she met my father, a scandal where I come from. She converted to Catholicism when they married, a mixed marriage where I come from. Even though she'd been through all the necessary rites and sacraments by the time I was born, I like to think it was me, her fifth child, who transubstantiated her into a true Catholic. What self-respecting Catholic woman stops at 4 children? I can recall several Catholic families in my hometown with over 20 living children, not to mention the gaps in the birth order that indicate the two or three stillbirths, or young children lost to illness or accident. The Catholic mother in a family like this would have to start early and produce, on average, one child every 16 months for the duration of her childbearing years. In my hometown, Catholic families are large enough to be basketball teams, baseball teams, football teams, both sides, offense and defense. They're a rural version of the Kennedys, happy and self-sufficient, whole Sundays of fun rolling around together on endless green farm lawns. But our parents, it seemed to us growing up on the farm, were hopeless dullards. We had no vacations, no road trips to monumental sites. We went to Bismarck 2 times a year to shop, and only on days when the weather was too miserable to work. In addition to the wheat, we grew flax, oats, barley, and alfalfa. We had chickens and eggs, sold cream, and raised livestock for slaughter. We had a vegetable garden larger than the hobby farm acreages of most of my adult friends, and we were dairy farmers, milking up to 75 Holsteins at one time. Dairy farming is as close as one can come to slavery and still be a technically free person. You must be on site every morning and evening to milk cows. In addition to the farm, my mother worked part-time at a clothing store in Napoleon, and my father was now part owner, with his brother Ben, of a bar in town called The Spot. Both he and mother worked at The Spot, some mornings and afternoons, and always on Friday and Saturday nights. As children, we knew our parents largely in the context of work. We went to church early on Sundays. Then we spent the rest of the morning cleaning the bar from the mess of Saturday night. I still remember the incense and candle smell of church being replaced by the ash and yeast odor of stale cigarette butts and spilled beer when Dad swung open the front door of the bar and we piled in to clean. If we worked fast, we each got a walnut crush as a reward. On a farm where survival hangs in the balance, there is no tolerance for tantrums. We children were expected to be well-behaved and hard-working. No room to be moody, temperamental, or high-strung. Yet all manner of extravagance was foisted on our Holsteins. We knew them as individual personalities with names like Mooney or Queenie or White Sox, usually based on the black and white markings on their coats. Our Holsteins were idiosyncratic and particular, too sensitive to be milked by strangers or even distant blood relations. They had specific likes and dislikes, ways they could and could not be touched. Each cow preferred a different stanchion, for example, and you had to know when to let her into the barn to be milked, so you didn't let in another cow at the same time who liked the very same stanchion. It would be mayhem. They were like aristocracy, these Holsteins, expecting a specific quantity and quality of oats waiting for them when they slipped their heads through the stanchions. Their level of happiness determined how much milk we extracted from their teats at 5 in the morning and 5 in the afternoon, the 2 times a day we milked them. This is why dairy farmers can never travel to any destination from which they cannot return by 5 o'clock the same day. The word husband, in its earliest origins, means to be bound to the house, or housebound. A peasant, for example, who owns his own house and land. It also describes one who manages his affairs with skill and thrift, as in, to husband one's resources. In its most literal sense, the husbandman is one who tills and cultivates the soil. As the word implies, a husbandman marries himself to the land, agreeing to nurture and care for it over a lifetime. In the history of my family, for as far back as it is possible to know, we have been husbands of the land, or farmers, a word that takes its origins from firma, or earth. On the North American continent, my great-grandfather reinitiated the contract when he immigrated to Dakota Territory in 1885 and took up a land claim. My ancestors believed that rain follows the plow, that the practice of farming a place, even an arid place, would transform its meteorology, and their experience had given them nothing to prove otherwise. 200 years ago, in 1803, my great-great-great-grandparents had immigrated to Russia from Alsace-Lorraine along the Rhine River in Western Europe. They were royalists on the run from the French Revolution. Answering an offer of free land from Tsar Alexander I, they migrated east and took up virgin land claims near the Black Sea, breaking sod on the Russian steppe, an ancient grassland that had run like a corridor across Eastern Europe, Siberia, and Mongolia for centuries. So when my great-grandfather Marquardt fled Russia and arrived in Dakota Territory in 1885, he encountered something entirely familiar, another treeless steppe, the ancient grassland of the North American Great Plains that had been home for thousands of years to native tribes such as the Arikara, Hidatsa, Mandan, Missouri, Lakota, Dakota, and Yankton Sioux people. Richard Manning noted in his book, Grassland, that the settlers came to the plains flush with this notion that the wilderness is in need of taming and the desert is in need of being made to bloom. In one ungrazed stretch of grassland, Manning wrote, one could identify 250 species of plants inhabiting a single site. With work, a plow, and chemicals, a wheat farm drags the count down to one species. First-person accounts taken from those who broke sod describe it as a violent popping sound, like a zipper opening or pistons firing. Beneath this complex tangle of roots, they found a topsoil, rich and deep in some places, sandy and rock-filled in others. For better or worse, once the land was cleared, they set to work cultivating and shaping it in order to make a life from it. As a daughter of agriculture, I understood early that the relationship with family land was painful, satisfying, devastating. It was all-consuming, the most passionate kind of love affair. In Grassland, Richard Manning documented that this ancient and complex root system that dominated the Central Plains most often defeated the farmers who tried to find sustenance from it. Quote, their ancestors filled poorhouses, insane asylums, and graveyards in a battle against the grass. And this story was repeated in counties all over the Great Plains. Wes Jackson reported in Becoming Native to This Place that his neighbor, Nick Fent, the owner of 240 acres in Nebraska, has researched and written a 70-year history of his three contiguous 80-acre plots of land in Rice County. Fent chronicled the negative spiral of land ownership on and beyond the 100th meridian, the cycles of drought when crops failed completely, wet years when the creek-bottom cornfields were too soft to work, and plagues of grasshoppers that ate everything from corn stalks to hoe handles. Among the plagues that followed were blight, extreme poverty, isolation, alcoholism, and insanity. As Fent researched the succession of deeds to his land, he discovered that between 1885 and 1955, 14 families had tried and failed to survive on what was now his center 80 acres. Dell, Hawkins, Decius, Crowell, Minor, Carnal, Curtis, Lowridge, Shoal, Haley, Ashman, Wetchel, Walker, and Mills. Reading this list of surnames is sobering. My great-grandfather's gift to us, his progeny, is that he managed to keep four generations of our family on the land, out of the record books, numbered among the survivors rather than the failures at subsistence farming. I begin to feel the miracle of it. At the same time, I understand too well the costs. The first vehicle I ever drove was my father's tractor in the hayfield. How good a driver can you be at 10, your legs too short to reach the pedals, your head barely clearing the steering wheel? In the field, hauling bales, I negotiated the bumpy rows with the tractor and its large flatbed trailer. I was the youngest girl, big teeth and spindly arms and legs. No good for lifting, so I had to be the driver. I'd climb up the gigantic tires of the Alice Chalmers and plant myself behind the wheel. To engage the pedals, I'd have to shift the entire length of my body to the right or left, hang onto the wheel, and extend my foot as far as possible. Walking behind the tractor in the field are my sisters and my brother, only a few years older than I, heaving and hoeing alfalfa bales onto the flatbed. If I buck the tractor by accident, or lurch the clutch, or accelerate too quickly, I will look back and find them all glaring, red-faced, and angry at me. In front of the tractor, standing in long vapor streams of heat, is my father. He waves his hands to signal me forward as if he's trying to park a 747. He screams two words at me, whoa and go, which look amazingly alike when you're reading lips over the roaring horsepower of a tractor. Sometimes I go when I'm supposed to whoa. Sometimes I whoa when I'm supposed to go. Everyone is mad at me. All morning and late into the hot afternoon, my father is alternately shocked and horrified at my stupidity, at my inability to follow simple instructions. At night, when I go to bed, I can still feel the vibrations of the tractor steering wheel pulsing through my forearms and palms. Many years later, when I call my oldest sister, Kate, to verify these memories, she confirms them, then tells me a story I've never heard. In her version, I'm still the driver, but I'm only 5. She's 12. As the oldest, it's her job to prop me in the seat of the tractor, push in the clutch, and get the thing into first gear. As the tractor begins to idle along, she gets my hands set on the wheel so that I will steer it straight down the field in an even row. Once she accomplishes this, she jumps off the moving tractor, careful to keep her body clear of the big tires, and joins the others, who are picking rocks and tossing them in the trailer I'm towing. When I hear this story, I'm stunned that I have no trace memory of it. I imagine myself at 5, small for my age, dwarfed in the giant scoop of the tractor seat, my short legs dangling in the air, the hot disk of the sun above me, the big circle of the wheel that I must grasp, and in front of me, the huge open field, the long day of endless rows waiting to be driven. When I reached the end of each row, my sister's job was to make a run at the tractor and land safely on the moving platform. Then she would turn the tractor around and set me up for steering another row. How she managed all this at 12, I have no idea. When I was born, my sister Kate was so excited that she broke into hives. She went to school to tell her second grade class that she had a new sister. And when her teacher casually asked what my name was, my sister began to weep. She felt so ashamed that she had forgotten my name. I was her baby doll girl growing up. Our mother was busy with a million other chores, so Kate often was in charge of dressing and bathing me. When I was 9 months old, Kate fell down the stairs with me in her arms. When we landed at the bottom, I had a bloody nose, and she had a cut on her chin. But my mother always remembers that my sister cried longer than I did, just from fear of having possibly harmed me. "It's a wonder we all survived to adulthood," Kate marveled that night we talked on the phone. At that distance, we could laugh about it in disbelief. We were the fortunate ones, averting major catastrophe. But I wonder now what kind of small traumas my oldest sister may have sustained as she planted me behind that wheel, then jumped on and off a moving tractor all day, not only for her safety, but for mine, and for the crush of responsibility that she would have felt if something had happened to me. My friends who grew up in the other 1960s America, the one with swimming pools and green suburban lawns, find these stories impossible to believe. They say I must be misremembering, adding hardship over time, like those old people who insist they walked 10 miles to country school each day in knee-deep snow, uphill, both ways. I call my second oldest sister, Elizabeth, to confirm the stories. She says, yes, she remembers all this. Then she tells me about another time when we all hauled alfalfa bales in 100-degree heat on the 4th of July. She remembers this day most acutely because the field bordered Highway 3. She and Kate were teenagers at the time, and they watched the road mournfully as cars full of their best friends and their boyfriends passed by and honked their horns, heading north to the lake. Despite the peaceful, idyllic look of a farm, it's an easy place to lose one's life. Anyone who has stood beside even the smallest farm implement knows how deadly the machinery can be. Grown men have been crushed under the deep grooves of tractor tires. No year passed in North Dakota without news of someone losing a hand, an arm, an eye, or his life in a farm accident. People who work around farm machinery every day forget how dangerous it is. A switch gets flipped, and a man is snuffed to death inside his silo, drowning in a sea of the grain he's just harvested. Farmers with 40 years' experience get absent-minded and reach into a stalled baler or the turbine of a combine and are dead within minutes. As young children, we had no business being near farm equipment, much less operating it. All my life, I've wondered why every industry in the country has laws to protect children. Garment, meat packing, mining, shipping. But the children of agriculture are left to work, according to their parents' needs and discretion, on family farms. Was it spring or fall, that Saturday afternoon when the phone call came with the news about Benny Moss? We were flying kites in our big backyard. I remember most the crispness of the wind and the way my mother's voice calling from the house rose above the flapping of the kites. It would not be the last funeral I attended for a boy from school who was killed in the fields. I was 10. Do I remember it so vividly because, before the news came, the day had been so perfect. Flying kites, the thrill of feeling the tug of this fragile contraption bobbing in the wind. Benny was 15, my brother's age. Like my brother, he was an only son. His sister was in my class. She was a shy, blonde girl who rarely spoke. But now I wonder if her chronic silence, her constantly averted eyes, preceded or followed her brother's death. For a long time after that, it was not possible to look at her without thinking that her brother was dead, and that it could have been me. I could have been the girl in class with the dead brother. In my family, we all understood from the beginning that my brother's life was claimed for the farm. From the time he was a young boy, he worked as an equal beside my parents, as early and late in the day as they did. He rose at 5 o'clock with them each morning to milk the cows, no matter what the weather. When he became a teenager, he worked longer, harder hours than anyone, in the fields at harvest time, the tractor going up and down the rows at night. Only the dim headlights of the tractor could be seen from a distance in the darkness. I remember his soft blue eyes peering out from a face caked black with dirt when he'd get home at 11 at night during harvest time. My mother would have held a plate of food for him, and he'd sit hunched at the dark kitchen table eating alone, his arms, his neck, his jeans, his boots caked with dirt from the fields. The next morning he was expected to be up early for milking, then out in the fields for another 18-hour day. From my earliest memory of my brother, he was quiet and gentle. While my father was explosive, growing more impatient and frustrated with anything that did not cooperate with him, my brother took after my mother's father, Grandpa Geist. They were calm tinkerers. They could fix anything. Animals and machines purred in their hands. Even though Nick was only a few years older than I, he was paternal with me as a child. When I was 5, I got sick and had to take a vile-tasting medicine. After a few nights of watching me cry and thrash as my mother forced the thick pink syrup down my throat, my brother gathered every stuffed animal in the house on my bed, then cooed and coddled me until I allowed him to spoon the medicine into my mouth. After what happened to Benny Moss, my feelings grew more tender toward my brother. I gave him extra potatoes when I dished up his food. I plumped up his pillows and tucked in his bed sheets with greater care. I worried about the tired groans I heard from his room early in the morning when my father called him from the bottom of the steps for chores. I hated to think about him going out in the cold. I wanted to spare him, but I didn't have the strength or the will to offer myself in his place. I came to understand that he worked so hard because there was only one of him, a boy, and there were so many of us girls. On the farm, my mother worked as hard as any man. My sisters and I worked according to our own abilities, but my brother did the most perilous work with my father, going out in blizzards, staying up all night during calving season, running the combine during the harvest, just as Benny Moss had. People said the farm accident that killed Benny had been some slip with the equipment. I never knew the details. Some said his father was possibly at fault. I have always wondered, how does a family recover from this? My mother was 19 years old that rainy night she accepted a ride from my father. From pictures, I can reconstruct her beauty, her wide-open smile, her good posture, her straight white teeth. Once she got into the car, there was no hope for her. She told me all this one Christmas Eve a few years after my father's death. It was just the two of us, and we talked late into the night. And this will end our reading today of Horizontal World, Growing Up Wild in the Middle of Nowhere. The book is written by Deborah Marquardt, professor of English and coordinator of the Creative Writing Program at Iowa State University in Ames, Iowa. You've been listening to the Community Bookshelf, which you can hear every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday evening at this time. I'm Mary Richards, producer. I wish to thank the chief engineer, Rick Morrison, our program engineer, Ron Latson, and the assistant producer, Janet Kloss. If you want to listen to prior episodes, you can check the bookshelf page on the KHOI website. We welcome comments and suggestions at 515-292-2878 or khoiradio@gmail.com. Thank you very much for listening.